I'm Kyone Wolf. They say spring ahead, fall back. But since today's show is over, I'm just going to go back to sleep.
Kyone?
Betsy, hi. What is it? I'm doing my last word thing.
This show's not over. The show's just starting. I think you're a little mixed because of the time change.
Wait, wait, wait. People haven't heard my introduction yet? The one where I didn't win the New York Marathon because I'm too busy writing a protest song for the YouTube Music Awards about the lack of diversity on Saturday Night Live?
That hasn't been on yet.
And did it just become clear that I don't listen to the show when Colin is talking?
A little.
Curse you, anonymous hooded figures who decide what time it is. Look, there's no way I can get back in sync today. I'm just going to go home, sleep it off, and try again tomorrow. And now, federal agents just seized his massive collection of Korean girl group music videos. Colin McEnroe.
Those music videos are very important to me, and we will be discussing them a little bit. Not my collection so much, but we will be discussing them a little bit later on in the show as we talk about the Music Awards, the YouTube Music Awards, the latest awards show with Eric Dan. I do want to say before we get too deep into today's show, you may have heard, you may be seeing on the internet that CCSU, Central Connecticut State University, is currently in a lockdown. As far as we can tell, there have been no acts of violence so far. It looks as though this may end relatively peacefully. But if you're there, obviously pay attention to the lockdown. Don't come out until they tell you to come out. And if anything does change, if anything happens, we will let you know about it. But as we say, so far, there are no reported acts of violence or anything like that. Thank the powers that be. All right. So we're going to do another one of these Monday shows. We tried one last Monday. We had a lot of fun. And so we decided we would do it again. And basically what we do is, theoretically, anyway, we don't really decide anything until Monday. We don't really sort of decide on guests. But that just, I've discovered that just means that the producers fret about this all weekend long. One of the things that we discovered last week, one of the important discoveries of last week was we decided we would do a large segment on Lou Reed, and we did. He had died over the weekend. We did it. We had Jim DeRogatis on. He was fine. And then a few days later, I was listening to Slate's weekly podcast, Hang Up and Listen, where Mike Pesca, America's foremost sports journalist, happens to be with NPR, but is also a regular contributor or panelist on Hang Up and Listen, did this really fascinating, you know, 7-minute riff on Lou Reed. And I thought, oh, well, I know Mike Pesca. I could have asked him to talk about Lou Reed, but I didn't know that he knew about Lou Reed. And then I realized that there's sort of no way to know exactly what Mike Pesca does know about or what he's thinking about. There should be some kind of index published somewhere, but there isn't. So now I just feel like I should just ask him what he wants to talk about. Mike Pesca is joining us right now. He's America's foremost broadcast sports journalist. He's with NPR, and as I said, on Slate's weekly podcast, Hang Up and Listen. Mike Pesca, welcome to the show. I assume we should at least say something about some sports thing, and obviously there was this big marathon in New York yesterday.
Yeah, they ran all past my window. I recently moved to First Avenue. It's awesome. Isn't it awesome? It's the only elite event in the world where just the citizenry also gets to participate, right? Like if during the World Series were played on diamonds that touched each other and there was like a beer league, softball league team right next door and maybe some little league game going on at the same time.
Yeah, so 50,000 runners yesterday. And I did discover this term today in the New York Times, the sub-elite runner, which sounds not good, actually, but it's actually a rather flattering term, as it turns out. To be a sub-elite runner means that you're not nothing. It's just that you're not, you know, a first-line competitor.
Yeah, I'm trying not to be churlish because, you know, I walked outside. The runners, well, the elites got off at 9, and I think everyone was off the Staten Island, off the Verrazano Bridge by 10-something. And at 4:30, there were still a few people straggling past my door. And so I think there needs to be, you know, your elites, your sub-elites, your general, and then your good for you.
Yeah. I think there should be a category called you're just not trying.
Okay. I know it's a marathon is a big thing that we all get behind, but maybe it's not the right event. No, good for you.
Good for you. All right. And was there, I mean, obviously we've had two major marathons in the United States over the last 12 months that have been compromised by different things. You obviously had the bombing in Boston and you had Sandy last year in New York. Was there kind of a breath held for this one?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I think New York knows how to do these big events. I think all the cities do. And, of course, there was extra security and stories about extra security, and everything went off fine. And I don't think that people were really seriously questioning if a big city has the ability to pull it off. Of course, New York came through. That's what we do.
Any other sports lessons learned from this one?
Yes. I think go with the Kenyan. If someone asks you to bet on who's going to win the marathon, go with the Kenyan.
Well, I was also reading about the – I think she was the first runner-up, the female runner who's originally from Ethiopia but moved to New York, settled in the Bronx, fell in love with the city, and then was unwilling or unable to train for long periods of time at any kind of high altitude because she was so homesick for New York. So one of the lessons to winning the New York City Marathon is don't get too attached to New York because you can't train there as well as you can in Albuquerque.
Right. She got Deba got out kicked by the winner, Jeptu, who had – the female winner has this strange running style. Like, you don't think her stick legs would be able to support a human being of any poundage. And she's a thin woman, but a tall one. And she kind of kicks out her right leg. And I was on the Let's Run message board. And, well, people from Let's Run know this, but she just doesn't have a great running – a compact running style at all. But it's that's what – sometimes that's what makes the greats. That's when you watch them, you're like, you're not supposed to do it that way, therefore you're more compelling.
And there's also some astonishing statistic among these runners. I noticed today that the men's winner, at one of his later miles, like at the 20-mile mark or something, he did a 4-minute and 45-second mile as part of his marathon run, which, of course, most of us would be hard-pressed to do simply as a mile.
Yes, sometimes when they get to a point where they're really running quickly and they think they're going to win, then they could kind of let the strategy out the window. And often the strategy is not to run as fast as you can. In fact, in marathon running at the elite level, that's pretty much the definition of strategy, how exactly not fast to run. And so at the end, when it's like game on, they'll just go, what the hell? I'll go as fast as I can.
That turns out to be pretty fast. And when I say most of us would be hard-pressed to run a mile in 4 minutes and 45 seconds, in my case, hard-pressed is really kind of an understatement.
Chest-pressed, yeah.
Yeah, chest-pressed, exactly. Well, while all of this is going on, you also are a day away from a mayoral election. And you know, this is a mayoral election, Mike Pesca, where the polls kind of indicate that this is just not a competitive race. Does it suck the excitement out of it for New Yorkers, or are people really palpably still engaged with this run?
I'm just so glad that the polls are so far apart that we don't have to do those in the last day challenger closing stories, like with the New Jersey Senate election. I mean, people always talk about the media being biased. Its greatest bias is towards a good story. So they always make a huge deal out of polls that really don't even show anything within single digits, right? So that's what happened with Cory Booker. But apparently Joe Loda is something like 35% behind Bill de Blasio. And it's both of those things are amazing. I mean, I guess we take it for granted, like that's how we look at history. Oh, yes, it was always inevitably going to wind up this way. But Bill de Blasio was such a long shot. He was, you know, in a field which wasn't really dominated by people who they were just going to put the crown on, but people thought, like, you know, oh, Christine Quinn is a strong shot, and before all of Wiener's problems, of course, he would have a strong shot. You know, de Blasio was way, way down on the list of people who could possibly win, and he won pretty handily. He avoided the runoff. And then Joe Loda, just, you know, if you asked anyone a year ago, this was right after Sandy and right after Joe Loda got a lot of prominence for everything he did, hey, is this guy going to have any chance in the election? I think everyone would say, yeah. And then if someone said to you, oh, what if I told you he'll be running against Bill de Blasio? One year ago, you asked anyone who knew New York politics, they'd be like, oh, my God, he could probably wipe the floor. How did de Blasio win? Did everyone else, you know, die in a fiery caboose wreck? So it's now this inevitable thing that, you know, just a short while ago seemed crazily unpractical and not going to happen.
And, I mean, de Blasio really is somebody who at least articulates a radically different vision from the vision that New Yorkers have lived under for many, many, many years of the incredibly long Bloomberg reign. As you walk around the cities, you talk to your fellow New Yorkers, Mike Pesca. I mean, do people really sort of have a sense, believe that in a de Blasio administration, a new wind would really blow, that things would really be substantially different?
This is really interesting. Okay, first of all, I think that Bill de Blasio, his mayoralty, will be a referendum on urban liberalism, full stop. I think that nowhere else in America is someone who's just pretty much a dyed-in-the-wool liberal will have the controls of power, will be able to get his agenda passed. I mean, there are members of Congress, there are some senators who are really quite liberal, but no one who actually runs a state or a city, a big state, this is the biggest city, has this much power. So, you know, if he succeeds, it will be seen as a lot of liberal ideas succeeding. Perhaps if he fails, it will be judged the same way, too. So that's really interesting. The other thing is, I think Bloomberg, I mean, the polls show that Bloomberg has at once been a really good mayor and at once has engendered huge fatigue because he's a three-term mayor, and that's what happens. And de Blasio is just the opposite of Bloomberg. So even though this city, I really do think like a guy like Rudy Giuliani hit on the zeitgeist. We wanted New York cleaned up, and it was cleaned up, and he brought a lot of baggage with that, good or bad. And then Bloomberg was the technocratic mayor who was just going to run things as smart as a lot of these people in the city are. So a lot of his initiatives, you know, have not only been successful, but have been so successful that every city in the world copied them, right? You know, if Dublin has a smoking ban, then the idea of a smoking ban is a really successful one. But he's also so bloodless, and he's also such the ultimate technocrat. He has, like, no connection to the common people and the people who feel like they're the other half of the city, and that's exactly what de Blasio is talking about when he talks about, you know, his tale of two cities and all that. So he's definitely the right guy for the moment. And I think people are kind of captivated by him and his family and his son's haircut and all that.
Definitely the son's haircut. And for those reporters who were just scrounging around for the last-minute story that you were talking about in this pretty widespread race, Harry Belafonte at least did help out yesterday. He said that the Koch brothers make up the heart and thinking of those who would belong to the KKK. They are white supremacists. They are evil. They come into New York City. They're beginning to buy their way into city politics. The Koch brothers, that's their name.
Yeah, to which de Blasio said, oh, no. Well, I noticed it like a day before he said that, I was reading that Time story where they gave a few reporters a tour of the U.S. embassy in Iran and Tehran, and there were all these like crazy propaganda setups. You know, this is how the U.S. controls the media. And then apparently, according to this reporter, there was just like a straightforward shrine to Harry Belafonte.
Harry Belafonte is everywhere. Actually, Harry Belafonte's speech inducting Public Enemy into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was really startling. It turned out he really knew a lot about Public Enemy, had a stronger bond with Flava Flav than I would have guessed.
He's suing the King children. He is. He's everywhere.
He's everywhere. All right, we're talking
Harry Belafonte's moment.
That's right. It's Harry Belafonte's world. We're just living in it. We're talking to Mike Pesca, and we're talking about whatever he wants to talk about. A couple more topics to get here, to today. This one you pointed out to me, and I had sort of missed this somehow, but obviously Jimmy Carter, the model, really, of the mild-mannered, pacifistically inclined ex-president, broke character a little bit and described his anger, his incredible anger at the former president of South Africa. I'll let you take it from here, but this is a different Jimmy Carter than the one we've always known.
So Jimmy Carter told South African News that the closest he's ever come to punching a head of state is when he wanted to level Thabo Mbeki, because Mbeki he's an AIDS denialist, or was for a long time, and was doing nothing to help any of his people and just obstructing all efforts in combating AIDS. So Carter said the first time he met him, he wanted to punch him. He was being such a pain. Now, I did the math on this. It was pretty unclear. The news reports were sketchy about what exact year it was, but we could pin it down somewhere between 99 and 2008. And Thabo Mbeki has quite a few pounds and about 20 years on Jimmy Carter. In other words, was born in 1924, right? So he's 89. Doesn't that make him 89?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So when he was going to take this punch, he was maybe 70, and Thabo Mbeki was around 50, so it might not have been that smart a move.
Right. You can give up the years like George Foreman, but you can't give up the pounds. George Foreman certainly did not.
It seems, and that also ties in with this other thing that's going on with the NFL and bullying, where a guy on the Dolphins, a big lineman, claims that he was essentially bullied or really harassed by his teammate Richie Incognito, and the guy Jonathan Martin, you know, I guess I was watching CNN and they were saying, oh, how could a big guy be bullied? If you know anything about social dynamics, it's quite possible. But player after player, former NFL players like Mike Ditka and the lineman Ross Tucker and all these players, like, why doesn't he just punch him? There seems to be in our society, like, this, just punching a guy seems to be not something you tell a child to do, but if an adult does it or says he wants to do it, usually get patted on the back for that.
Well, yeah, and in the NFL, certainly during training camp, there's almost this kind of tacit understanding that things aren't good if there aren't so occasional explosions, you know, during these one-on-one contact drills and stuff like that. If in fact, you know, an offensive lineman doesn't hook up and really start trying to punch a linebacker, there's something wrong with the team if they go all the way through the summer without that.
Yeah, and every coach thinks he knows exactly exactly how to gauge the temperature. Okay, a few of them are good, but you don't want them actually throwing fists and cracking them on the helmets and things like that. I don't know. It's just another indication that the NFL, not your typical workplace.
No. Last topic, Saturday Night Live has been critiqued a lot lately for the fact that they added 6 cast members, all of whom are white. Last night, they kind of experimented with that. And Kenan Thompson, one of their 2 African-American cast members, has said he won't dress up as a woman anymore, which seems like a reasonable thing, even in comedy, to insist upon. At least he won't solve their problem about not having female African-American cast members by dressing up as a woman. They had an African-American woman on last night, Kerry Washington, Saturday night, Kerry Washington, and they dealt with it by doing some, first of all, an opening skit about their lack of diversity in this area, about the fact that they don't have an African-American woman. They made fun of themselves without really promising to change anything. They got Al Sharpton to come on and kind of sign off on that as they went into the opening of the show. But then did kind of a funny, interesting show with a lot more Jay Farrow, the other African-American character, than we typically see, and kind of showed us the show they would do if they were a little bit more diverse. Now, what do you make of all that?
Well, first of all, I think that there is something to be said for these are actors, these are impressionists. You know, we have gay people playing straight people, we have white people playing, we have Asian people playing white people, we have all sorts of kind of diversity within who gets to play who. But of course, and I understand why, due to the nature of blackface and the horrible history with that, like, that's the one line we don't cross. A couple weeks ago, one of the SNL cast members, one of the female cast members, pretended to be Aziz Ansari, the Indian-American comedian. And I saw in a few of the blogs, they were talking about this as being brownface and how Saturday Night Live doesn't get it. You know, I'm usually the guy who says, if you're playing a character, you're playing a character. And I was fine. I didn't think that a Fred Armisen's Obama impression was great. And I think Jay Farrow's is better. I mean, technically better. I don't know if he gets to the soul of Obama like Peele does from Key and Peele, but Jordan Peele. But I was fine with Fred Armisen playing it. I thought it was really weird that some of the justifications, like there needed to be about why Fred Armisen was playing Obama, was, well, you know, he's half Venezuelan. So? But Saturday Night Live would definitely do itself a favor by having a more diverse cast, because then you could do a whole bunch of different sketches. You know, it doesn't surprise me that Lorne Michaels, who's, you know, pretty old and set in his ways, he knows what he's doing, but it doesn't surprise me that this is the sort of thing that eludes him. But, you know, I don't look at Saturday Night Live as a place that needs diversity for the sake of diversity. I just think it needs to, you know, do itself a favor by giving yourself a wider range of your 15 cast members have, you know, a black woman. And by the way, they have 2 black men in the cast. 2 out of 15 is 13.3%. It's almost exactly right in line with the percent of the American public. I don't know that Lorne Michaels ever promised us a cast that looks like America, but, you know, that alone in terms of having 2 black guys in the cast is not underrepresentation.
It certainly would have been okay on many editions of the Boston Celtics anyway, although they've changed. All right, Mike Pesca, so great to talk to you. So great to pick your brain. I hope you'll do this with us again in the future.
Absolutely.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
All right, that's Mike Pesca. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. By the way, no new news at CCSU. Still a lockdown. Still no actual real violence or anything like that. So thank the powers that be for a so far scary but ultimately violence-free day on the campus. All right. Welcome back to our Monday show. And in fact, we do invite you to call in on this segment. We are going to talk about time changes, about the annual madness of daylight saving time, to steal from the subtitle of a book by our next guest. So I first of all want to say, if you're struggling through the time change, if you either like it or don't like it, this is your chance to sound off. 860-275-7266. That's 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. We've got our tweet master, Greg Hill, in the house today. today. We're going to talk to Michael Downing right now. He teaches creative writing at Tufts University and is the author of several books, including, as I just said, Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time. Of course, we just fell back on Sunday, and many people find it disorienting. Michael Downing, there are a lot of debates that go on around sort of twice a year. There are debates of this kind in which people try to discuss the advantages and disadvantages, whether the harms outweigh the benefits of having this system of changing time twice a year. But maybe you can help us understand, how did this begin in the first place? Whoever thought it was going to be a good idea to have two different time systems?
Well, I'll tell you, you know, like so many other things, Ben Franklin almost invented daylight saving time in the middle of the 18th century when he was in Paris and noticed people sleeping through the very early sunrise times. And he actually suggested that the Parisians ought to fire off cannons to wake up their lazy citizens so they wouldn't waste the resource. That didn't go over so well. But by the 20th century, when the whole world is on clock time, it's actually a Brit, William Willett, who, importantly to the story, is a sportsman and a lover of natural resources, who begins to get the same idea that instead of sleeping through this morning of sunrise, if we turned our clocks ahead, people would rise more in time with the summer sunrise, and then they would have an extra hour of daylight at the end of the day. That's the beginning of the modern plan of daylight saving.
And first of all, who does this? I mean, who decides? I understand that the two states of the union don't subscribe to it. Is there some kind of central authority that decides that we're going to do it, when we're going to do it, which weekend of the year it's going to happen?
Well, since 1966, which was when we first got a national peacetime daylight saving law, until then it had been entirely a mishmash of policies run by individual cities. We turned it over to the Department of Transportation and then the Department of Energy, and they then coordinated through the federal government this idea that states either had to wholly adopt daylight saving time or have none at all. And so now it's just Arizona of the continental United States which has refused to adopt daylight saving, and Hawaii has never observed because it is so close to the equator, it really has no appreciable difference in available sunlight throughout the year.
Now, one of the arguments for it is an economic argument, but it does seem as though the studies of this are at best inconclusive. And one chance you get to study it a little bit more is if somebody adds it or expands it, as Indiana, I think, did a few years ago, or if a few weeks of it are added, so you can maybe sort of measure the difference between having 3 extra weeks and not having 3 extra weeks of it. Do any of these studies indicate that this really works, that it actually saves energy, saves money?
No, we've been trying to squeeze a drop of oil out of our clocks for 100 years, and we have yet to come up with an energy saving. There are a couple of reasons for that. One is that there is just not enough available sunlight throughout the year to justify daylight saving. But the more important reason we don't save energy is that what was never measured in all the studies of how we consume electricity and other energy was gasoline. From the beginning, the petroleum industry and the automakers were big supporters of daylight saving in the 20th century, and there's a reason for that. If you give Americans more sunlight at the end of the day, we really do go outside more, and we go to parks and we go to the mall, and we don't walk there. Daylight saving actually increases driving. So as an energy policy, it's a loser. But as a retail spending plan for some industries, it's a genuine winner.
By the way, as I said, our number is 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Our guest, Michael Downing, wrote Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Savings Time. Let's talk to Joyce in Cromwell. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I just wanted to register that in the opening, it sounded like you were going to say that falling back was harmful to people. And my contention is that the springing forward is what's harmful, and where they register that more people have heart attacks after that, losing that hour of sleep. And I personally hate it the entire time when we spring forward, and I just wait until we fall back, until I can get my hour of sleep that I lost back in the spring. And also, having worked as a nurse, all nurses who work in the 11 to 7 shift know that in the spring forward, if you're on that night, you get to have a 7-hour shift. But in the fall, on the fall back, You have to work a 9-hour shift.
You know, I never thought about that, but that there are some people who simply maybe get caught in that and have that exact experience. Well, Michael Downing, a lot to work with there. People typically don't parse it out, I think, all that carefully, that the spring forward is harmful, the fall back not so much. What's your reaction to what she says?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. First of all, the problem for all of us is that since Congress every 20 years has increased the period of daylight saving, so we've gone from 6 to 7 and then in 2006, 8 months, daylight saving is now essentially standard time. We're only on standard time 4 months a year. But there are studies, it's really interesting, that show people have a trouble adjusting at both the beginning, the spring forward moment, and the fall back, in part because, you know, the problem of losing or gaining an hour is, of course, theoretical at best. But what it does do is it creates a different slant of light, for instance, for drivers when they go out, whether it's the spring or the fall. And there often is a small uptick in accidents as a result, and those sorts of small numbers that people experience as a dramatic change in their personal lives.
Yeah, I thought her thing about the nurses was pretty compelling and pretty interesting. I hadn't really thought about that some people might actually have to work an extra hour simply because their shift is in the middle of that time change and there's no other way to account for it. The heart attack thing is something that I've heard. Were you able to either sort of confirm or deny that this has some kind of correlation to heart attacks?
Well, like the auto accident statistics that we see, the numbers really have always been too small to be genuinely statistically significant. Most of the studies that we are quoted are really, there was a Scandinavian study and a Russian study of this heart attacks, but they're more anecdotal than any sort of significant numbers. And by the way, you know, all sorts of confusions, including those in hospitals, have long been associated with this project, including the problem of dating babies' birth if they're born on this hour that we have apparently lost, and which date is the actual birthday. So it goes on and on, the complications that fooling with our clocks causes.
So it's not hard to find voices for reform. You know, I mean, the title of your book suggests right away that you're a voice for reform. And I read a number of pieces this weekend, including a much circulated one that not only suggested the rescinding of daylight saving time, but also shrinking America down to just, well, I guess it wouldn't be a shrinking, but switching America over to just two time zones while you're at it, which the more I thought about it, the more sense that it made. But so it's easy to find people like you who are advocating getting rid of this or at least sort of stopping the madness. On the other hand, the madness doesn't stop. As you suggested, it expands, so now it eclipses standard time. There doesn't seem to – how would anybody go about getting rid of the whole time change? How could that be accomplished? Or I guess what I'm really asking is, what forces are there in place creating the inertia that makes it impossible for it to change?
I think the inertia comes because many of us and the majority of the population live in the northern part of the northern hemisphere, and we really appreciate long summer evenings and late summer sunset times. And so the social appeal of daylight saving is genuine, and people get addicted to believing that we're owed that as part of our summer bonus. So history tells us that we are not going to get rid of this project. In fact, every proposal that has been made to get rid of it has failed, and those that have tried to spin forward the clock permanently, which is one solution often proposed, have met with a very peculiar result. We tried it during World War II and with a full year of daylight saving. And what happened in cities like Detroit and Chicago and New York is that come March, even with the clock advanced, people's fingers got itchy, and they turned their clocks ahead again to something that they referred to as double daylight saving time. So it seems unlikely that we're going to reverse the project.
That's the worst argument I've ever heard, though. I mean, the idea that anybody would do that seems like the worst argument. I mean, that seems like the smart thing to do, right? Let it spring forward once and leave it there. If people like their long summer evenings and their late sunsets, fine. Just leave it there and never change it. And that's the only significant argument that's mustered against doing it that way, is that some people would start adding an extra hour onto it just on their own?
There's another argument, which is that Richard Nixon attempted daylight saving during the winter when he was trying to stem the effects of the Arab oil embargo, still clinging to this idea that we might be able to save energy with it, which was a failure. He had to rescind it almost immediately because here's what happened. You turn the clocks ahead and you keep them ahead in, say, February. If you live in the western part of your time zone, you might not see a sunrise until 8:30 in the morning for 4 months of the year. That puts all school children on pitch black streets. It took only a few small accidents where school children were killed on city streets to rescind the policy.
I guess that's sort of, that makes more sense than the other thing anyway. Well, Michael Downing, if I gave you a magic wand and let you just decide what we would do about this, what would you do?
I'd go right back to the 1966 Uniform Time Act, which gave us 6 months of daylight saving during the longest months of the year when we have a lot of extra available sunlight, and I would go back to 6 months of standard time. It was a really wise compromise that, unfortunately, Congress has since compromised out of existence.
I don't know if you saw the article this weekend about with an economist suggesting that we also ought to just condense all these time zones so we only have two. But as somebody who thinks about that a lot, what's your take on that?
Well, I think, you know, there are problems associated with that. China has long, by the way, completely failed to observe time zones. So that all of China, which is the same size from east to west as the United States, is a single time zone. But you have to consider that means people in L.A. and people in Washington, D.C. would be enjoying sunrise simultaneously, though it would look very different in terms of the time on the clock. So I think before we begin to tamper with standard time, we should just stop fussing with the clocks as much as we do and figure out how much standard time we're going to have per year.
All right. Well, that sounds like a good place to end. But Michael Downing, thank you so much for your time. I don't know which bank it came out of, but thank you very much for spending a few minutes with us.
It was fun to join you.
All right. Michael Downing teaches creative writing at Tufts University, and he is the author of several books, including Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Saving Time. We'll be back after this. Grandfather's clock, or just a common old sundial sitting out on a rock. Then the dollar watch, it had its day, and the wristwatch, it was fine. Then along came a man that ruined us all with daylight saving time. I'm a-hunting that man who first thought up daylight saving time.
I had 3 cups of coffee and a little green pill, and now my body clock is set at 7 a.m. on Tuesday, which means that technically I'm in New Zealand, and you are not going to believe some of the stuff that's going to go down in the next few hours. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, with help from our intern, Greg Dyson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Eminem. Check out WNPR.org for stories, photos, and audio from today. We'll be back tomorrow with a show about narrative in the age of distraction, featuring novelist Robert Stone. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, so just a few quick things here. First of all, this is kind of an experiment we've been doing here this Monday and last Monday to do shows that are less elaborately planned in advance and react to things in real time, kind of figure out as the weekend unfolds what we really want to do on Monday. We're curious to know how you like this. So give us an email, if you would, about that or anything else at Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. Let us know if you like these shows and let us know other things that are on your mind. Oh, also want to mention, yeah, tomorrow should be a really interesting show. There's a conference going on at Wesleyan about narrative in the age of distraction. The conference concerns not just fiction and authorship, but also the way that people use stories. People use stories, narratives to explain themselves medically to care providers. They use narratives sometimes to help ex-convicts set themselves straight. But increasingly these days, a narrative seems to be kind of splintered and people's attention spans are not what they used to be. In the age of Twitter, can you get people to read long novels? Can you get people to think even in terms of a story arc? So we will be talking about that, and Robert Stone, one of America's most acclaimed novelists, will be part of that conversation. On Wednesday, by the way, we'll be talking about opera. Opera companies are folding right and left because the economics just don't work. On the other hand, opera seems to be one of the really hot places for telling really interesting stories, including the story of Anna Nicole Smith, cyber operas, all kinds of sort of small chamber operas doing really radical things. So we'll talk about both things, the way that the big opera companies are struggling to stay afloat, and small guerrilla opera seems to be thriving right now. All right. There was yet another award ceremony, just what we need, another award ceremony over the weekend. But it was different. It wanted to be different. It was the YouTube Music Awards. It was to celebrate the way music thrives on YouTube. It was set up in a way as to kind of defy some of the conventions of award shows. And it was streamed. So Eric Danton is a contributor to Rolling Stone. He also writes about music and pop culture for the Wall Street Journal and Salon. He used to be the rock critic for the Hartford Current. Been on our show many, many times. And Eric, right now, anyway, you're really interested in the whole role of YouTube as a content creator. So first, set the stage with that. What is the role of YouTube these days in the world of music?
It's an ever-growing one, really. I mean, YouTube, you know, they attract 1 billion unique hits a month, and people there are watching 6 billion hours of content every single month, which is, those figures are just staggering. You know, if any news organization had that kind of traffic, there would be no problems in terms of layoffs or staffing because the money would just be rolling in. They won't say how much of that content is music, but the amount of music content that people are watching, they will say, is increasing exponentially. It's their numbers are crazy, and it is very difficult to think of YouTube these days as anything other than a major force for music and music discovery.
And I think the other thing that's sort of fascinating too is even trying to figure out what is a lot of page views in the world of music. For example, Girls' Generation, and don't worry, we are going to treat you to a few bars of Girls' Generation, I Got a Boy, in just a second. But that has 74 million views right now, which is a really lot of views, except when you consider that Gangnam Style by Psy has, I think, 1.5 billion views.
Yeah, I think it's up even further now. It might be up to 1.8. It's, the numbers for that are out of control. He should have won all the YouTube Music Awards.
So, you know, in many senses, in sort of really sort of mammoth popularity senses, whether we're talking about him or talking about Justin Bieber, who ultimately, I guess, could be claimed as a YouTube discovery, it's not really just sort of the little underground acts that are thriving there, right? It's big, big stars are becoming big, big stars, at least largely on the strength of a YouTube beginning.
Some of them are. I mean, Bieber and people like Psy are not exceptions, but they're not the rule necessarily either. What's interesting, I think, is how big stars like Lady Gaga, like Katy Perry, even Arcade Fire, and even Paul McCartney are using YouTube as a promotional tool in a way that even 2 or 3 years ago you didn't necessarily see happen. You know, there's this constant content paradigm now, and I wrote about this in a story that's running this Friday in the Wall Street Journal, where artists are continually pumping out new content, new videos or new audio streams or whatever onto YouTube to sort of keep their names in front of fans all the time. And YouTube is a great place for that because there are no barriers. You can shoot it and post it and get immediate feedback on it.
I think also because people are using their computers all the time, it's just become, I even find for myself, if there's a song that I hear or hear about that I'm curious about, the easiest way to solve that problem is just to pull up the YouTube video of that song. That is the gateway for a lot of people for any music these days.
It is, although it's funny that you say computer because for young
people, I'm an old guy.
It's all mobile.
Yeah.
You know, everything is mobile. I mean, there are statistics too. Something like 64% of teenagers find music on YouTube.
Yeah.
You know, radio is still the primary discovery tool for older people like us, but for teens, it's all YouTube.
So YouTube decides they want to have an award ceremony. They want to make it different. They have sort of a different idea about who the host would be. It's Jason Schwartzman and Reggie Watts. These are not necessarily household names, except in my household where the movie Rushmore is considered some kind of religious artifact. But they're not household names. And they sort of decided that they wanted, like, they wanted to do things different. I'm going to let you take over because, I mean, they did as many things different as they possibly could, at least in the process of staging and giving out awards.
They did. I mean, the whole conceit of the show was staging live music videos. And you could argue that the MTV Video Music Awards does that a little bit with some of their live performances or some of the big production numbers at the Grammys are similar to that as well. But this was more a celebration of the act of creating a music video as opposed to necessarily the finished product of a music video.
And so, I mean, one of the things you're going for, obviously, when you do that, the more you loosen up the format, the more you get live and get unscripted. I mean, first of all, the fact that you're not on broadcast television means a lot of things can be said that can't be said elsewhere. Lady Gaga can have the F word in the song that she performs. But what you're really going for is what might be called that Madonna moment, where somebody makes out with somebody they're not supposed to make out with, or at least something happens that's so unscripted and so buzzy that it's all anybody talks about the next day. And I get the feeling, although I did not treat myself to the entire streamcast of this, that didn't happen.
It really didn't happen, no. And the template that they were looking for there has been established by the MTV Video Music Awards. That's where Madonna made out with Britney Spears. That's where Miley Cyrus twerked on Robin Thicke just a few weeks ago. So from that standpoint, there were no water cooler moments like that. You know, the closest thing probably was when Butler sort of stage crashing the I can't remember which award it was, but stage crashing content, YouTube content creators receiving an award for something and saying that, essentially pulling a Kanye West moment and saying, I'm going to let you finish, but Harlem Shake was the video that deserved this award the most. And, you know, that's fine. It's amusing, but it's already been done by Kanye on the Video Music Awards.
They did things like, at least one of the awards, the two hosts, I think, had to hunt through birthday cakes to find they had to sort of paw through frosting to actually find one of the awards.
Yeah, for Lindsey Stirling, who is another YouTube-created star.
Actually, I said we were going to play K-pop in just a second here. Before we do that, Wolfie, let's since he just mentioned Lindsey Stirling, this is one of the award winners last night. Just to kind of give you a sense, and this might even be, we'll let Eric comment afterwards, but this might even be an example of something, yeah, that is kind of YouTube-specific, a cover of an Imagine Dragons song, Radioactive. All right, yeah, so that's the aforementioned Lindsey Stirling and Pentatonix. So, Eric, tell us a little bit about that. We're talking to Eric Danton, by the way, contributor to RollingStone.com, also writes about music and pop culture for The Wall Street Journal and Salon. This is an act that at least can be said to have germinated on YouTube, right?
Yeah, in fact, Lindsey Stirling told me in an interview recently that if not for YouTube, she would still be playing sets in college cafeterias during lunch. So she credits YouTube for her career, and she tried the traditional route, you know, trying to interest record labels. She went on America's Got Talent. She did the things that artists used to do 5 or 10 years ago to try and become household names, and she did it through YouTube, where she has something like, I think, 3.5 million subscribers and more than 450 million views of her videos. So she's doing pretty well. It's funny because she is someone whose songs, as she herself put it, they're not necessarily radio-friendly. She plays violin. She doesn't sing. There's very much a visual element to what it is that she does. So YouTube, for her, is really the perfect platform.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of look and feel to a musical presentation. Not only does she play the violin, but one of her prominently featured bandmates plays a cello, I think. And not that that's all that new, and groups like Arcade Fire have proved that you can have any kind of instrumentation and make your mark on the music world. But I suppose the less comparable you are to anything else, the harder it is to get one of the accepted models for breaking music to accept you as something that's going to work.
That's absolutely right, and she's doing something that is different from what most other people are doing. I mean, she calls it dubstep violin, which is not typical instrumentation for either violin or dubstep.
You know, obviously they wanted some of that. They wanted that sense for these music awards of these groups that only exist because of YouTube, that thrived and flowered because of YouTube. But in a way, just looking at the featured acts, the things that wound up being part of this award ceremony, it did seem like it was kind of hard for them to move the big pile of stuff that is just sort of, you know, part and parcel of any music award ceremony. I mean, you know, with acts like Lady Gaga and Eminem, who I guess really appeared in defiance of the whole spontaneous let's do it live ethos of this award show, it did seem like it could have been any award show, at least on that basis.
Yeah, it did. I mean, there's only so much you can do to mess with the format of an award show, because ultimately the point of an award show is to hand out awards. So you can't really subvert the template that much and still have something that resembles an award show that you're going to attract people to watch.
Eminem, do I understand this correctly, that Eminem sort of did appear in kind of essentially a pre-recorded format?
I'm not sure whether it was pre-recorded or not. His thing was very simple. It very well could have been pre-recorded. It was essentially just him rapping against a white background, it looked like to me.
He had a kind of a strange weekend because his Saturday Night Live performance became – it was so weirdly partly lip-synced and he got a lot of bad press on that too, I gather.
I mean, the funny thing about his YouTube Music Awards performance is, you know, for being sort of the least interesting performance of the night, it also, from what I have seen and just sort of flipping through, it's gotten the most views too. His video has 78,000 views, which is double what most of the stuff last night got. So by contrast, the Grammys in 2013 attracted 28 million viewers on TV.
One of the award winners, and I think it did win Video of the Year, was a K-pop group called The Girls' Generation. Their song is I Got a Boy. I know all of you out there have been waiting for us. When are they going to play I Got a Boy? All right, we're going to play it now. Oh, I just want to let it keep running. But, and you know, Eric Danton, I don't know how much of a K-pop expert you are there. One of the things I have to say about K-pop, though, is I was saying this before we went on the air. You know, groups like sort of boy group bands and stuff like that, they always used to have four people. And then, you know, because of New Edition or NSYNC or something, it all turned out to be five. But K-pop groups, they always have like so many members. I lost count of how many members of Girls' Generation there are.
There are a baker's dozen of members in K-pop groups. I mean, K-pop is a really interesting phenomenon because without YouTube, really, K-pop would not have the global audience that it has. Mm-hmm. Psy really helped bring it to prominence with Gangnam Style last year. But because these K-pop groups are making really colorful videos that anyone can see anywhere, they've really sort of made themselves an indispensable part of music on YouTube. That's how they're getting discovered in places outside of Korea.
Yeah, I mean, if Pastel was the name of an animal, PETA would have to protest this video because many pastels died to make this video. I mean, nothing in the color spectrum was spared to create this. But and I don't know. I saw comments on the YouTube video that has the 74 million views saying, well, this is really bad K-pop. You know, K-pop really is this important force in pop music. And it is, I think we all understand that we're standing there watching a wave approach us that's going to be a big impact. But this isn't a really good example of it. And I couldn't tell whether that was true or not, although as I was watching it, I found myself shuffling my 59-year-old feet and kind of dancing a little bit to the beat. So I don't know. Where does Girls' Generation stand in the K-pop firmament?
As with anything else, there are going to be people who claim that the only real K-pop is the stuff that they're the only ones who have heard. You know, it's they're great until everyone else finds them. Girls' Generation kind of fits into the middle of the pack of K-pop, as far as I can tell. You know, they're not the rare, undiscovered 15-member K-pop band that's making pastel-colored videos, and they're not quite Psy yet either, but they're pretty indicative of what K-pop is all about. They're catchy songs and brightly colored videos and just kind of bubblegummy.
And they won. Okay, well, we got 30 seconds left. Tell us something that we can, it doesn't have to be K-pop. In fact, it probably shouldn't be K-pop. Tell us something we can go look at on YouTube this afternoon, some kind of music that will make us feel like we're watching the thing that at least 74 million other people haven't already watched. But that's pretty cool.
Well, there's so much. I mean, that's the thing about it. But I am a fan of a guy named Nathaniel Rateliff.
Oh, yeah.
Some videos on.
You should have seen the other guy.
That's right.
Yeah. You introduced me to that song.
His new stuff on on YouTube that are well worth watching.
All right. Eric Danton, you are my guru. You're the only reason I know who Nathaniel Ratliff is, and many other things as well. Thanks for joining us today. If you liked the show, let us know. If you hated the show, let us know. Colin, C-O-L-I-N, at WNPR.org. That email works either way.
That I get. Tell me, am I famous? Yes. Have I got a million hits? YouTube. Have I got 1,000 hits? YouTube. Have I got 100? YouTube. Have I got a hit? YouTube.
Let's go.
Live from the third floor of the Dankosky Building, I'm Kyone.
Kyone, the show is over.
What? I thought it was the beginning of the show, November 4th, 2009. I give up on this daylight savings crap.